طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. The main purpose of this program is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This is your host, John Roberts. This week we take on the bias of the American media on the presentation of news and analysis concerning the Israel-Palestine issue. We feature the voice of Palestinian journalist, author, and screenwriter Rual Jibril. She was born in Haifa, educated in Italy, where she began her journalistic career, being the first female foreign anchor on Italian television. She eventually was driven off Italian TV for becoming a persistent critic of President Silvio Berlusconi. She then went to Egypt, where she also was driven out of the country for her on-air criticism of the Egyptian government. Here in the United States, she had hoped to experience a more free and open environment for journalists, but as you will hear, has faced enormous problems for critiquing our media for its biased coverage of the Israel-Palestine conflict. You may remember the incident during the Israeli assault on Gaza in the summer of 2014, when NBC reporter Amin Moyadin reported the bombing death of the four little boys running on the Mediterranean beach. He was initially taken off the air by NBC for his contextual reporting of the event, but later restored to his position when NBC was assaulted in social media for silencing a reporter for doing his job. It was an outrageous act of censorship. Rual Jibril, an MSNBC contributor at the time, went after NBC on the air. Shortly thereafter, Amy Goodman interviewed Rual on Democracy Now!, where she continued her criticism of the mainstream, not only NBC, but all of the media for its inept, biased reporting on the Middle East. We begin our program with this interview of Rual on Democracy Now!
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
We turn now to the controversies around media coverage of the crisis here in the U.S. Over the weekend, NBC reversed its decision to remove veteran correspondent Ayman Mohyeddin from Gaza. Mohyeddin was removed shortly after he reported on witnessing Israel's killing of four boys on a Gaza beach. His reports gave voice to Palestinian victims and placed the siege in the wider context of Israeli occupation, drawing criticism from supporters of Israel's offensive. NBC's decision to remove one of its top reporters sparked a massive backlash on social media, with the hashtag #LetAymanReport becoming a trending topic on Twitter. Days later, NBC backed down and Ayman Mohyeddin resumed his reporting on Sunday. In a Twitter post, Mohyeddin acknowledged the social media campaign that demanded his return, saying, quote, "Thanks for all the support. Proud of NBC's continued commitment to cover the Palestinian side of the story."
On Monday, one of MSNBC's frequent contributors, Rula Jibril, took to the network's airwaves to criticize the initial decision to remove Ayman and the broader exclusion of Palestinian voices. Jibril was speaking on MSNBC's Ronan Farrow Daily.
We are ridiculous. We are disgustingly biased when it comes to this issue. Look at how many airtime Netanyahu and his folks have on air on a daily basis. Andrea Mitchell and others. I never seen one Palestinian being interviewed on these same issues.
Well, I'll push back on that a little. We've had Palestinian
voices. Maybe for 30 seconds, and then you have 25 minutes for Bibi Netanyahu and half an hour for Naftali Bennett and many others. Listen, the Ayman Mohyeddin story. Let's talk about this. We are home and we can discuss this. Ayman Mohyeddin is covering the Palestinian sides and we get upset. It's too pro-Palestinian. We don't like it. We push him back, and thanks for social media, that brought him in. Let's talk about these
issues.
Point
taken, but doesn't it reveal equally our thinking that we now have Ayman Mohideen on air, and I think there's been very fair and balanced
coverage. Yes, thanks to social media and thanks for the pushback from the public opinion. And I'm not saying that everybody's like this, but it's one-tenth is giving to the Palestinian voice and 99% to the Israeli voice, and that's why the public opinion is pro-Israeli, which is the opposite in the rest of the world.
Shortly after the interview, Jibril tweeted, quote, "My forthcoming TV appearances have been cancelled. Is there a link between my expose and the cancellation?" On Tuesday night, she appeared on MSNBC's Chris Hayes.
We're joined now by Rula Jibril to talk about what happened. Rula Jibril is an author and political analyst who frequently appears on MSNBC. She worked for many years as a broadcast journalist in Italy, where she also covered the Middle East. She's the author of Miral, which was made into a film by Julian Schnabel. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Thank you for having me. It's good to have you with us.
Can you talk about what happened and the decision you made to speak out on your own network?
Well, I decided to speak on my own network because we are liberal Democrats, and part of the debate of any media in the liberal democratic landscape is to discuss our own flaws as well as others, not only Bridgegate, but also Mediagate, I would say, and media scandal regarding the bias covering of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I looked at studies, and the studies that were made by many scholars, respected American scholars, Juan Call and others, who are referring to the covering of the media, how much airtime is giving to the Israeli officials and how much airtime is giving to the Palestinian official. And it's a U.S. landscape that is so biased. So, for example, in 2012, you had on CNN alone 45 Israeli officials interviewed versus 11 Palestinians. And when it comes to this conflict today, in 2014, you have 17 Israeli politicians, official interviewed versus one Palestinian. So we are going backwards regarding this issue. And that forms and shapes the public opinion in America that then transfer and become political support unconditional to Israel. To a policy that is very destructive both to the Israelis and to American stance in the world and their credibility.
Were you the only Palestinian consultant or contributor on MSNBC?
Absolutely, yes.
So what happened after your appearance on Ronan Farrow, where you said what you said, criticizing their coverage?
I received emails of cancellation, and I asked a question about whether these cancellations are related to what I said earlier. I never had any. Tried to call the producers, and nobody answered the phone. Then I tweeted what I tweeted, and immediately there was a social media uproar. I understood. Listen, I worked in Egypt. I was kicked out of the country because I interviewed Amr Suleiman, the head of Secret Service. I asked him about torturing. I interviewed Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. I'm accustomed with this. When I pushed Silvio Berlusconi on corruption and scandals, my TV show was shut down. I'm accustomed to this. I did not, with all honesty, expect this from us liberal media and us who are advocating going out saying we tell the truth and we cover this in an unbiased way. I did not expect that.
The alternate writer, Max Blumenthal, spoke to an anonymous NBC producer who he said described, quote, a top-down intimidation campaign aimed at presenting an Israeli-centric view of the attack on the Gaza Strip, unquote. In his piece for Alternate, Blumenthal wrote, quote, the NBC producer told me that MSNBC President Phil Griffin and NBC executives are micromanaging coverage of the crisis, closely monitoring contributors' social media accounts and engaging in a, quote, witch hunt against anyone who strays from the official line, Blumenthal wrote. The producer told Blumenthal, quote, loyalties are now being openly questioned. Did you have any experience of that, Rula?
I've been there for 2 years, and I have to say I was talking about the American landscape, not only MSNBC, which has been actually a little bit better than others, but I never experienced anything like this. I mean, I understood doing what I did in Egypt would lead me to be kicked out of the country. I understood in Italy, where Berlusconi controlled most of the media. I was shocked because most of my friends in the Middle East would tell me, you know, you will have an issue in America. And I always thought, no way. We're truth tellers. We're fact checkers. We're people that actually cover both sides. This is what America stands for. And I hope that MSNBC and other networks will actually revise their policies and will have more voices. It doesn't have to be me. It's not about me. We have a media scandal that we need to expose. We are responsible of these failing policies in Gaza and in Israel.
And you tried to raise this before in the 2 years that you were a contributor.
Privately, I raised it with so many people in the inside. I've been pitching myself to talk about these issues on many shows. And I've been privately meeting with producers and others, and I told them, I said, listen, you have an issue there. Our credibility here at stake. We can't talk about Bridgegate for 6 months, and then when it comes to this, we decide, we duck our heads, and we decide to be exactly like the other networks. We can be different. We can be much more bolder, and we can be aggressive. And maybe the rates are this way because of this. I think most of them were agreeing privately with me, but then when it comes to what goes on air, I don't think they didn't have any power.
Now, you did go on Chris Hayes last night.
Absolutely. Chris Hayes contacted me late in the afternoon.
And he's on MSNBC.
And he's on MSNBC. Of course, we disagreed, but, you know, in the media, we can't agree to disagree. We have Joe Scarborough criticizing over and over, and he's fine, and he's okay. But one thing is to criticize certain things, but is this a hot issue that nobody can touch? Is this what America is becoming about?
So did you lose your job as a contributor?
I have no idea. I still don't know. My contract is up, and we're negotiating still. Hmm.
And following your appearance on the show, you said one of the things that you hoped your comments would precipitate would be a national debate on the question of Israel-Palestine and how it's covered. What kind of shape do you think that debate would take? And if it were up to you, what kinds of issues should be raised more frequently in the mainstream media on this particular issue?
I think what we need to ask, are we really guaranteeing by supporting unconditionally this Israeli government, right-wing government, are we really helping Israel being more secure in the long term, and ultimately American interest and stand in the world? Is that what's happening? And look, this policy with Gaza has been failing for the last 8 years. We had 6 bombardments in the last 8 years, and this did not topple Hamas and did not limit, weaken Hamas. Actually, it empowered more and more Hamas and martyrs like myself. And for me, Hamas is the ultimate liability for the Palestinian people. But this did not empower moderates. Moderates has been telling Israel over and over, we want a peace deal. We will agree on most conditions that you want. And as Gideon Levy said, in this venue, in this same venue, the problem with our policy that we want to keep the status quo, that means military occupation in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza under siege. And we want, and what we are doing in the media, we're portraying actually a false image where what's happening in Israel, and if you ask anybody, in whether in New York, in D.C., in other places, what do you think is happening? They will tell you, oh, well, Israel was minding its own business. The Palestinians start shooting missiles out of the blue. This is not the reality. This is not what's going on. And the context of this is what leading the public opinion to support unconditionally Israel. And politicians will do what's popular, not what's right. We need to do what's right. We in the media have a mission, whether it's MSNBC, Democracy Now!, CNN. We have a mission. We're truth tellers, and we can shape public opinion to protect public interests.
Rula, you have a fascinating story yourself, which you wrote about in your book, Miral, which was made into a film. Can you talk about where you were born and your own life story?
Look, I was born in Haifa. I am an Arab Israeli. I'm a holder of an Israeli citizen. I have my family lived all of their lives in East Jerusalem. I was raised in an orphanage. My family is both Muslims and Christians. I am married to a Jewish man, and I really believe in two-state solutions. A year ago, I discovered that I have a Jewish sister because my mother, that died when I was 5 years old, actually had a relationship, and I discovered a year ago that I have a Jewish sister that is tweeting today. And these days, killing Arabs is a value. This is the reality that I live in. And I have to be truthful because of what I've seen in the Middle East and because of what I witness, whether it's in refugee camps, under military occupation, under siege. I've seen how pain, grief, and when you keep 60% of the population that go almost hungry to bed, and 90% without clean water, the only thing that can rise is extremism. And the solution to this is not to bombard them all together in one place. The solution to this is actually lifting the siege, empowering them financially, and let them themselves create a moderate leadership that eventually can take over. We didn't manage to topple Hamas, and this is facts. This is we are failing in our strategy in how to contain extremists. Hamas was dead politically. We will manage with this war, actually, to revive Hamas and its power and its grip on the Palestinian cause.
How did you end up going from Haifa, growing up in an orphanage, to becoming a broadcaster in Italy?
Simply, when I was 17 and a half, I won a scholarship from the Italian government. I went to Italy. I studied there. I attended college. I became the first anchor on the Italian television, foreign anchor on, black anchor on the Italian television. I was attacked by the right, especially during the Iraqi war, because I challenged their views on the Iraqi war. When I visited Iraq, it was clear to me that there is no way that a military solution will be met with cheering, and it was clear to me that the country would be divided immediately and the Shiites will take over. So I wrote about this. I was challenged by the right-wing government in Italy on these views. I was even called the N-word on air by one of the ministers of Silvio Berlusconi, who actually was pushed to resign 3 days after because of the uproar of the media. Because of that. Then I worked for so many years in Italy. I was a reporter. I read the news. And then I decided to go to my own world. I went to Egypt. I worked there for 3 months. I was on-air journalist. I broadcast a TV show until I started asking the wrong question and tough question to the establishment. After that, I was off-air, kicked out of the country. And I hope to find a platform somewhere.
And you've worked, you just talked about your work in Italy. How would you say the reporting in Europe on Israel-Palestine compares to what you've seen since you've come to the U.S.?
Day and night. And simply because of the images that reporters bring from the ground and are allowed to show on air. Here, you know, we have a problem with what we show. The tipping point for me is when people like Rihanna and Selena Gomez are not even celebrities allowed to sympathize with the people that are dying, not with Hamas. When they wrote their Twitter and saying, you know, we pray for peace in Gaza and we sympathize with the victims, and everybody backlashed on them. And when even John Kerry was scared when his microphone was open on Fox, and then he had to actually walk back that line. That shows you something. Everybody's scared when it comes to these issues. It's time that we in the media have the courage to expose so many wrongdoing from our own government here and their wrongdoing abroad. It's time to it's time really to do a service, not a disservice, to our audience and to our interest in the world. And also to the Israeli, many Israeli people that, and Jewish people, as you showed in your network, that are today calling on Israel to stop their policies.
Rula, we want to thank you for being with us. Rula Jibril, author, political analyst, frequently appears on MSNBC. She worked for many years as a broadcast journalist in Italy, where she also covered the Middle East, as the author of Miral, which was also made into a film.
That was Palestinian journalist and author Rula Jibril being interviewed by Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! During the siege of Gaza in the summer of 2014. We're going to follow up that interview with a presentation that Rual gave at the Conference on Israel's Influence held in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 2016. This was a rather incredible conference that we will revisit in future broadcasts of This Week in Palestine, because it spent much time and did great analysis on the way that our media is covering the Palestine-Israel issue. Rual was one of the keynote speakers, and this was her presentation.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Delinda and everybody at the Washington Report. They've been very active lately, not only organizing this amazing conference, but I have to say, I received a phone call from Delinda 2 weeks ago, and I was visiting some friends in Florida who had some health issues. And Delinda said, well, I need to send you something urgently, and I think you would be fascinated by it. I didn't understand why she was secretive. Then Monday when I came back home and I opened, and there was this package of emails of some producer in Voice of America asking a former speaker of AIPAC if he would be fine that I would be the guest to debate
to debate whoever they deem as a proper Israeli official, eventually to debate him on television about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And obviously, I will, you know, spare you some of these misogynist, sexist, disgusting details of the back and forth. But basically, this has been the way my career, somehow whenever I was hired by anybody in American media, and I love when they, you know, when they are about to prepare a war, whether it's a war in Afghanistan or in Iraq, and it's like, we are going to liberate women. We will teach these natives how to treat women. And then you read these emails, and it's like, sure. I'm sure you know exactly how to treat women and how to talk about them. It's fascinating to have, you know, the superior culture. But it's a glimpse of the kind of power that they not only established, they exercise and wield shamefully, without any shame. But I am sure these emails were not the only emails. These are the emails that we knew of. These are emails that we, you know, had access to. But I am sure if you read private emails, internal emails of any news outlet, whether it's the New York Times, CNN, MSNBC, you will find similar things where we're begging. Gideon said that the government is begging the Israeli government, and like, you know, we want to give you the money, and they're saying basically, no, we want more, and somehow we need to kiss their hands. But the media has played a major role in making this happen. You know, I grew up actually admiring American media. I grew up thinking American media is, you know, this is a media that managed to expose major cases of corruption in the history and force a president to resign. This is the media that inspired me as a child, because I thought, you know, you can live actually in a country where a simple journalist, a simple reporter can do his job or her job and can force the most powerful man in the land to answer some tough questions and eventually get, you know, be forced to resign or be impeached. I thought that's the kind of dynamic of a vibrant democracy that makes this democracy vibrant. That's the kind of, you know, journalism I didn't see around me. You know, I grew up in watching Arabic televisions where I knew that somehow somebody in the government has written the questions and maybe the answers also. So I grew up with that kind of culture, thinking, you know, something needs to change here. And I always looked up to Western media. So when I worked in Italian television, they hired me simply because I was the only woman that spoke Arabic. They needed somebody to understand the Middle East. They needed somebody that is native from the region to explain to them what went wrong. That famous article in Newsweek, what went wrong with the Arab-Muslim world. And I remember going to my director and explaining to him the difference between Shia and Sunni and why the Iraq war would be disastrous, because just simply looking at the numbers, the composition of the population in Iraq, 60% Shia. They sent me to cover the Iraq war. I started my career in Italian television, and I always love to be underestimated because it gives me more, you know, somehow more freedom, because as soon as they realize what they have, as soon as they realize what I was standing for, what I was doing, then these sexist, misogynist emails was some of the weapons they used and they throw against me. Obviously, it makes me laugh, but it makes me think that there's a lot to be done. American media has been the most disappointing thing I ever seen in my life. Even working in countries like Egypt, I've seen pushbacks by certain journalists, reporters, TV hosts, by far much more than in this country. And I'm saying that because I've seen how, what did that produce? Iraq was a war of choice. It was a non sequitur country that was invaded for a non-existential threat. And it could have happened only with a tacit, silent, and vocal consent of American media, who sold a lie. And none of these people have ever been fired. They've actually been recycled, and they're still called as experienced and experts on many issues, on the Iran nuclear deal, or and they're writing long essays about Obama's doctrine, as they call it. Nobody ever questioned their failures, their lies, their manipulation. None of that has happened. But they actually question the fact that, you know, my hair is long or short, or I am skinny or fat. I mean, we are reduced to a level that allowed and enabled every lobbyist to get away with murder and basically paved the way for Donald Trump to become the front runner. I think we're responsible of that. And it reminds me very much of the media in Egypt and Italy before the revolution. So when, you know, the title of the conference, Is This Good for America? Not only it's bad, you know, Israel influence here goes beyond Israel and Israeli borders. If you think of the larger dynamic in the Middle East, if you think how much money, you know, we're talking about $4 billion to Israel, think of the $2 billion to Egypt. These $2 billion are paid to the Egyptian regime that basically created a deep police state, a deep state, and doomed democracy in that country. This is the country that gave us Zawahiri, number one of Al-Qaeda today. This is the country that gave us political Islam. Inside the prison cells, the most atrocity has been committed. Torture since the 60s that produced, that basically radicalized an entire generation. And they left with one idea, transnational jihad. Go after the regime, create terrorist groups to go after the regime, blow up themselves. And guess what? Every one of their backers, starting with the United States. So somehow we enabled a government that produced mass radicalization. And on why? Because of one issue. Because of the Camp David Accords. Because of the Camp David Accords. Basically, we still give money to a regime that is committing atrocities and violating human rights and killing thousands of people and imprisoning 60,000 as we speak today. Because of that peace accord with Israel, or to keep the peace with Israel, or to do Israel dirty jobs. For example, you know, closing the borders with Gaza. The other ally that is, we never not only question it, but if you think of what Israel has been trying to push the United States to do, it goes beyond the Israel-Palestinian issue. We had Bibi Netanyahu who came here to testify in 2002, and his words was, we need to go into Iraq because it will have, and you know, do the regime change that we need to do, because this will have a positive effect on the entire region. I mean, you look at the region, I don't see any area where this positive effect you can see. But the whole issue was one, and they've been vocal about it. And the one issue is, now they are they don't even care about the Palestinian issue, basically. What they care about is the Iran issue. And the Iran issue has been the focus of this government for the last 20 years. So you have the Prime Minister, the Minister of Defense, Sylvain Shalom, and even the former Ambassador Oren, who basically are telling us that they rather have Sunni radical groups like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front, than any Shia group. As if the answer to the region is, yes, let's wage war on the Shiites and the Sunni who gave us every, not only radical group, every group that have committed atrocities are actually, you know, we can turn a blind eye on these guys. This is the same reasoning. This is the same mindset of the Cold War. This is exactly the same mindset and never changed. As if they are not realizing that the post-colonial order that's been established in the Middle East have collapsed already, doesn't exist anymore. And it collapsed because of their choices. The Iraqi war basically ended that post-colonial era. But they are still thinking as if they are living in 1979. The mentality of the Mujahideen was that mentality. There's a Russian invasion, so the Russians are the enemies, and this is the Cold War mentality, so we need to create an alliance with whoever is there to defeat that monster. So we created a Frankenstein monster that is turning on all of us. And we keep repeating the same strategies and the same mistakes. And I understand that it's hard for a politician to change because they are beholden to the checkbooks of Sheldon Adelson and Haim Saban. Somehow, you know, Sadly, they call it legal corruption in my world. Here they call it Citizen United. But the real failure has been my colleagues, the people who are sitting on television with a revolving door. They served as a person for AIPAC the 10 years earlier, and then they are on CNN as a neutral TV host or some prison guard who served is lecturing people on some, you know, website on how they need to be or to behave as journalists. Somehow the system allowed for these voices to thrive and to become the establishment voices. And, you know, when you listen to people debating, oh, how did we not understand that Trump, you know, would become a front runner? The signs were all there. The writing were on the walls. What were you thinking when for years, since 9/11, the idea of us and them became, from marginal idea, became a mainstream idea? The them, you know, was your neighbor who was Muslim or Sikh or eventually, Hasidic Jew or... Diversity, you know, the war on diversity started by eliminating critical voices in mainstream media in the United States. I mean, I can't even fathom till now how is possible that in a country that led serious investigative journalism and led to push an administration to resign with Nixon can be the country that allowed not only an administration to abuse their power and pass secret memos and spy on their citizens or torture some people. Our surprise today, you know, and some of these speakers are intelligent, surprised that you have fascists on the rise and basically telling you that you didn't actually do enough. You know, when I listen to these debates and I have... some of my colleagues who don't even have a follow-up question on some of these candidates who are not only calling to commit war crimes, but they are saying it's not even enough. You need to, you know, expand those war crimes because, you know, waterboarding is not enough. You need maybe to kill him in order and kill his family and his relatives because this is what will make us all safe. Look, I never been in my entire life I never worked so hard to make people understand what are the stakes. But I'm concerned for the next generation because, you know, when I grew up, obviously I watched that kind of journalist of Dan Rather and others. I think our children are growing up, if they are if they're 15, 16, or 14, and they look for people to inspire them. I mean, if that person is Anderson Cooper, I want to jump from a window. The follow-up question is matter more than the question itself. To push back and to, you know, if your job is actually to expose lies, corruption, and deflections, and push them to answer it, and the only person has been doing this somehow, and surprisingly, and I'm horrified to say that, has been people on Fox News. I mean, we're looking at Megyn Kelly as the person who managed to actually challenge some of these candidates. So, but, you know, we looked for years at the first African-American president being smacked by the leader of a country of 7 million people. And here you have a country of 300 million people, supposedly the leader of the free world. And with Congress basically accepting that and allowing that, that can lead only in one direction. This is the beginning of dismantling of a democracy of this country. And this is what is worrisome. The Israeli model is not contained in Israel. It's being transported and it's becoming part of the American model. So when you have police brutality and the police, and you know, the cozy relationship in the media, it's becoming a cozy relationship in the police departments. So the police you know, who abuse their powers in Ferguson has been trained actually by Israeli police, and it's considered normal. Nobody is investigating these kind of cozy relationship. I am proud actually to be sitting with Philip Wise here, who reported about some of these executives at CNN who are speechwriters for Bibi Netanyahu. I mean, there's the level of cooperation and propaganda has reached such a level that today it's normal. We are the abnormal. We are the aberration. These people are writing the chapter of this nation history. I can't believe that I'm mentioning, this is a quote from Gramsci, my favorite European intellectual, who wrote from his prison cells. And he was asked about Mussolini. And he said Mussolini was not an aberration. Mussolini was an autobiography of a nation. He was part of this nation. He was enabled by the media. He was himself a journalist. He was enabled by a system that turned a blind eye. I think we need to push harder, and we need to fight more. And I think we need to create a community that is, we are part of an ecosystem that can help each other to expose this more. We cannot allow ourselves to, I mean, I can't, obviously, 15 years ago, I used to throw my shoe at the television. I can't do this anymore. I'm very happy to be ejected from certain TV networks. But I'm very happy, actually, to be part of a system that whatever Philip or Max Blumenthal and other people write, we need to cooperate so we can push that message. And it can't be a parallel world. It must be a united world. Because the wave that is coming is by far much more dangerous. I've seen it in other places. I've seen it in Europe, and I've seen it in the Middle East. And these people are beyond ruthless. Berlusconi, when he was elected in 1994, the first three things that he did, he sued 18 journalists, kicked 18 others from television, from networks, people who dared to criticize him. Some of them were my friends, Marco Travaglio or Santoro and others. I worked for an Egyptian television. In 2009, after 6 months, I had to leave because the level of bullying and abuse was beyond me. I couldn't control it. It wasn't about me. It was about the people who worked with me. And I knew that while the establishment was talking about the transfer of power from the father, Mubarak, to his son, the people were talking about actually three things. And these three things still exist. They were talking about freedom, democracy, and dignity. And this is what I kept hearing from the ground. So the detachment from between the base and the establishment, and the gap is so deep, but we need to stay tuned with the base, because actually the base will lead the change. I don't believe the establishment will anymore, but I believe the base, the millions of people who were neglected around the Arab world, stood up one morning, apparently without any reason. 3 months earlier, Hillary Clinton said it's a stable country, and people ignored those voices to such extent that they didn't even bother to think or to ask them what you want, what you think. These people stood in the streets and demanded dignity. They overthrew a regime, they had setbacks, but that kind of power, that kind of sentiment is still out there. It's not dead. It's dormant, but it's not dead. I am sure it will rise again. I am sure, like I'm looking at you. And I hope in that moment we'll be ready to help them and build a bigger bridge, a bridge that will unite us here and in the Middle East. And it will not be about them and us, but it will be about all of us. Thank you.
That was Palestinian journalist Rual Jibril speaking at a conference on the influence of Israel that took place in Washington, D.C. We finish our feature on the media with a presentation made at the same conference by veteran journalist Philip Wise, co-founder of Mondo Wise. Here he takes on the New York Times.
Thank you very much. Thanks to Linda. I just have to say that Rula's invocation of the Vietnam War and what journalists did around the Vietnam War was very important to me, too, as a young journalist. And I remember that I was at the Philadelphia Daily News 35 years ago, and The guy at the next desk had read Harrison Salisbury's book about the Pentagon Papers. And that was when the New York Times took on the government. You know, the government tried to shut down the New York Times publication of this vital document that explained the history of the Vietnam War. And the Times stood up to the government. And, you know, it helped to bring, well, it took a while, but it was very important in bringing an end to the American participation in that disaster. And my friend at the next desk said, let's write to Harrison Salisbury. You know, we're never going to get a story like that. And so we wrote this letter and we said, dear Mr. Salisbury, you know, how do you plan your career? We were just young, ambitious journalists. How do you plan your career so that you can, you know, get ready to take on the government and, you know, have a big story like that? And what I remember about his letter is that he said, you know, just hang in there, learn to be good journalists, you know, work hard, and someday you will get your big story. And the thing I find really moving about that now is that, in fact, we did get that big story. We got it in the shape of the Iraq War. And just what American foreign policy has been in the last 10 years. And the New York Times has been AWOL on that one. And I think I may have said this the last time, that gives tremendous power to our community. If you think about how much information that people in this community are developing in the way that journalists are supposed to develop, traditionally, have developed information that's vital. Even this fact that both Rula and Colonel Wilkerson said earlier about the extent to which the aid package to Egypt is essentially a bribe to keep them to hold them. This is a central fact of our foreign policy that just you won't find stated, and that is on a par with anything that was in the Pentagon Papers in terms of a vital understanding. So I'm here to talk about the New York Times chiefly because the Times sort of sets the parameters and the tone for the mainstream discussion. And I did once do some work at the time, worked staffer at the Times Magazine. And I thought I would just anatomize the Times a little and then move on to the whys of it. Why is the Times sort of in the tank for Israel? So the newspaper has been a reliable Israel supporter for a long time now, and we keep looking for signs of a thaw. And I think, you know, I'm going to be hopeful, but let me first describe the character of that support. And I will be describing, as I go through my remarks, I'll be using the term Zionism. And I think that Zionism is embedded. It's a very important force at the New York Times. And what I mean by that is some degree of commitment to the idea of the need for a Jewish state and the need to preserve a Jewish state in Israel. So the Times has at least three columnists who are openly Zionist. And those are David Brooks, who has said that he gets gooey-eyed about Israel when he thinks about Israel and has been there a dozen times. It was a couple of years ago. I think he's been there more since. Roger Cohen, who says that Israel is justified by the Holocaust, but he can also be somewhat critical of the occupation. He is openly a Zionist, which I think is a very good thing in as much as he's frank about his adherence to the ideology. And then there's Paul Krugman, who is a liberal Zionist, who says he's critical of Israel, but never expresses it, says as little as possible. You would think that winning a Nobel Prize and having a Times column would give you freedom, but Krugman surely demonstrates Tolstoy's principle that the higher you get, the less freedom you have. And I'm leaving that other stratospheric columnist, Tom Friedman, out of this list because while Friedman began his career as an Israel supporter back in the suburbs of Minneapolis doing chalk talks on the Six-Day War at his high school, I think that one of the principles of this conference is that people can change. And I sense that Friedman has fallen away from the ideology in as much as he has said, for instance, that Congress is bought and paid for by the Israel lobby, which is a statement that if a non-Jew made it, would brand them as an anti-Semite. I think the standard is not being nice enough about Israel. He has also said recently that the two-state solution is a failure, and that that failure was produced by, among others, Netanyahu and Sheldon Adelson and the right-wing Jewish influence, openly speaking of right-wing Jewish influence. And that was a very important column, and I'll return to it because I think it's the heart of what I always understood journalism to be. Not quite the heart, because I always understood journalism to be what's new, true, and important. And it's true and it's important. It's just not new, what Friedman was telling us. I think you may know that David Brooks' son served in the Israeli military, and he's one of four Times reporters who have had children who serve in the Israeli military. The most celebrated example of this was Ethan Bronner, who was the previous Jerusalem bureau chief. His son entered while he was writing for the Times, and it was shortly after Cast Lead, when Israel slaughtered 1,400 Palestinians in Gaza. And it caused Palestinian activists, in a truly masterful act of branding, to paint the New York Times logo on the apartheid wall. I don't know if you saw images of this, but it was just kind of wonderful. Bronner introduced a guessing game into journalism about unspoken ideological agendas. This was, is he or is he not a Zionist? And I think that I participated in this guessing game. A lot of journalists in the blogosphere did. And when he left the newspaper, ultimately, in the last year or so, he left less and less doubt about this question, and resolved it entirely, when he hosted right-wing Israeli military figures at the 92nd Street Y in New York on a program that was about the quote-unquote incredible courage of Israeli soldiers. So when we started the same guessing game when Ethan Bronner's successor, Jody Rudoran, took over after him in Jerusalem, and I remember that I sort of was a little bit more credulous than others. I'm not proud of this, and I sort of thought, oh, she's going to be fair, and then But what we found was that she wrote totally out of the Israeli Jewish experience. That was really the community that she's openly admitted that she related to more, but she made little effort to get outside that comfort zone. So there were long pieces about young Israelis getting tattoos when their grandparents had had Auschwitz tattoos. There were there was an episode where she went to Gaza in 2012 and on Facebook said that Palestinians were ho-hum about death of family members. She would go to she went to a funeral in Gaza and observed that Palestinians were, quote, ho-hum about death of family members. It was just it was a shocking incident, and something she had to apologize for, but it wasn't a prejudice that she seemed to want to shed or to get out of. Recently, she gave some podcast where she said that she spoke one word of Arabic. Actually, I'm sure she speaks more Arabic. I mean, in that there are a lot of Arabic words in our language. I mean, alcohol and algebra to begin with. But it's a reflection of her deep in curiosity about the Palestinian experience. And it's kind of white citizen council journalism that you see in the Times a lot and that she exhibited. So I remember, because she was more adept at this guessing game about her commitment to Israel as a Jewish state, she said, the only ist I am is a journalist. She was, when she was asked about this question, I'm not a Zionist, the only ist I am is a journalist. And I remember that I once wrote that she comes out of a Zionist background. And she was upset about even that, being identified in even that fashion, and said, well, why would you say that? And I said, well, you know, you've said to Jewish groups when you've spoken to them that you are familiar with the American Jewish experience and the American Jewish concern for Israel, and you came to Israel when you were in high school with United Synagogue Youth. You know, that's a Zionist background. And she said, you know, I went to Lake Winnipesaukee, too. So it was one of the most disingenuous deflections I've ever experienced. I mean, because those trips by United Synagogue Youth and other Jewish organizations were highly ideological in character. They weren't like vacations in the White Mountains, and they were. It was a measure of her how obtuse she could be that she would make that kind of statement. In my one meeting with Ruth Oren, I told her that her great challenge was to tell Americans that this was 4 years ago that the two-state solution is over, and that. If you just go to the West Bank, you see that it's over. They won't be able to make a viable Palestinian state there. Those people don't want to leave. Just a little bit of an ad. Some of the journalism I've done myself lately about the West Bank, which we have out in the adjoining room, and that I said that, you know, she had to explain this to elites. This was a vital function of a journalist to sort of to bring this news, and she never did that. And it's not just that I made this challenge. You'll notice recently that John Kerry and Dan Shapiro from the State Department have both said, you know, we're approaching this one-state reality. Well, they've gotten no support from the leading American newspaper to explain what that one-state reality is. So the Times has sort of abandoned this kind of vital journalistic function of telling people what's going on in this kind of most important American relationship that exists. And I think that that again is one of the great things about this Tom Friedman column, was he said the Israelis don't want to leave. They've been supported in the West Bank. They've been supported by right-wing American Jews, and they just want an unending civil. It's going to be an unending civil war with greater and greater isolation of Israel on the world stage. All true, and this has been true for the last 5-8 years, I think, at least. And yet now, a Times columnist and the Secretary of State are the people who are bringing this information. So, in the time I have left. And by the way, I think that there is something very cruel about maintaining the illusion about the two-state solution, because it is it's saying that, oh, these horrible conditions, they're just temporary. These people, 5 million, you know, people under some form of apartheid or ghettoization, you know, in Gaza, in a prison, we're going to take care of that soon. And so it's prevaricating about a tremendous human rights atrocities all the time. It's White Citizens Council journalism. And if you think about the great Jewish seer, Rabbi Hillel, who said, if not now, when? This is a situation which demands, if not now, when? And the position of the Times is kind of whenever, and the position of these people who preserve the illusion of the two-state solution is kind of whenever, with respect to a tremendous amount of suffering, as Susie so beautifully showed us. So I brought in the Jewish piece, the parochial Jewish piece. I'm one of the American Jews who is in this in the conference today, and in my parochial capacity, I would just have to acknowledge that, you know, Zionism comes out of the Jewish community. It was an answer to Jewish persecution in Europe, and was embraced by the world or the Western world, the colonial world, as a solution of the Jewish question of Europe. And now that and it won Jews to its side through the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And now what we're seeing is a because of the unending the 50-year occupation, we're seeing even inside the Jewish community some questioning of this ideology. And I think that if Bernie Sanders says there is a war for the soul of Islam, America has to help Islam in that respect, there's also a war for the soul of Judaism right now. Whether this is a religious conflict or not, I'm not getting into that, but to the degree that the American Jewish community, including large parts of the New York Times itself, where Jews of my generation are working in great number, to the extent that the American Jewish community embraced this ideology and married this ideology and saw it as a deliverance ideology, that's something that is now beginning to come undone among younger Jews. And I would remind you, if you don't know it, that there was a time when the New York Times was anti-Zionist. When it did not see Zionism as the answer, it said, our homeland is here. We don't want our patriotism undermined by the creation of a Jewish state, and we're going to oppose it. And we're not going to send Jewish reporters over to Jerusalem because their loyalty, we don't want to place them in a position where there's any question about where our loyalty lies. So that era passed in the 1960s. The Times ultimately became an organization where many Zionist Jews work. And I think that there are no anti-Zionists openly at the Times, but that will come. It's bound to because of the changes, not just in the Jewish community, but throughout the American community, which is, I think, what we've witnessed at this conference. It's one of the, I think, the great things about this conference that it has brought together so many diverse perspectives, American interest, Israelis, left-wing, Palestinian solidarity people, and anti-Zionist Jews as well. And I think that, again, just to return to what I said at the beginning, this gives our community tremendous power from the storytelling, journalistic perspective. We are the ones who are developing this information, who are working through these extremely difficult questions of anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, separating those. We are developing experience about talking about these things, and that will also make us information leaders. Thank you very much.
That was Philip Weiss of Mondo Weiss speaking at a conference on Israel's influence in Washington, D.C. last April. That is it for today. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, and please join us again next Sunday. You are tuned to Truth and Justice Radio, 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.